It's Thursday, October 28, 2010. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. As we are so often rightly reminded, ideas do rule the world. Worldviews matter. Worldviews matter for everyone, including, of course, the President of the United States. Knowing an individual's worldview, coming to terms with how their ideas work, the basic principles and postulates of their thought, well, this helps us to understand the person. But some persons are more difficult to discern in terms of worldview than others. Harvard historian James T. Kloppenberg is writing a new book entitled Reading Obama, Dreams, Hopes, and the American Political Tradition. Writing about that book and the professor's work, Patricia Cohen speaks of an effort to discern a worldview when it comes to President Barack Obama. Mr. Kloppenberg argues that there is a discernible worldview. He argues that Obama is a rare type, an intellectual president, and he suggests that the intellectual tradition into which President Obama falls is that of American pragmatism, a school of thought, of course, identified primarily with figures such as William James and John Dewey. As Ms. Cohen writes, in the professor's analysis, the president's worldview is the product of the country's long history of extending democracy to disenfranchised groups, as well as the specific ideological upheavals that struck campuses in the 1980s and 1990s. End quote. Now, Mr. Kloppenberg compiled a long list of people who had influenced President Obama's worldview. They include Max Weber, Friedrich Nietzsche, Henry David Thoreau, and, of course, Ralph Waldo Emerson. Added to that, Langston Hughes and Ralph Ellison. Now, as he continues his list, Mr. Kloppenberg suggests that there is a very diverse set of intellectual influences on President Obama, but as he seeks to understand this model of what he calls the intellectual president, Mr. Kloppenberg at least dignifies the world of ideas. Thinking Christians will take note of this kind of analysis as we do understand the importance of worldview and as we seek to understand the worldview of others in order to understand who they are, how they make decisions, and where their thought is headed. Now, when it comes to President Barack Obama, I want to say that Mr. Kloppenberg is onto something here. Whether or not he is an exemplar of that identified as a rare type of the intellectual president, no one should doubt that this president is a serious man of ideas. The question, of course, is whether those ideas are the right ideas, true ideas, healthy ideas for the future of this country. That's where there should be a very spirited debate. At the very least, we should take seriously the challenge of understanding this president's worldview. One final thought from this Harvard professor's analysis, Mr. Kloppenberg concedes that President Obama remains something of a mystery despite his detailed examination. Well, there again, there's a Christian understanding for this. What man or woman actually knows his or her own thought without something of a mystery, much less the thinking of another? We are indeed intellectual and rational beings, but Christians understand we are far more than that as well. We are a mass of intuitions and impulses and emotions and experiences. The rational is very important, but we are not rational robots. Some persons defining pragmatism would suggest that it comes down to the effort to make the best of a situation by coming to the most, well, you've heard it, pragmatic solution. Now, in that sense, pragmatism is something that is deeply woven into the warp and woof of American culture. But remember that the pragmatism that is referenced here in terms of the worldview of President Obama also includes a very plastic or liquid understanding of truth. As indeed William James said, truth is something that happens to an idea. Now, keep that in mind when you consider Rob Stein's article in today's edition of the Washington Post. It has to do with criticism that is now being directed towards the Obama administration's position and program on high school sex education. It turns out that both from the right and the left, there is criticism, but for equal and opposite reasons. One thing I want you to note, given what we just talked about in terms of a consideration of the president's worldview, is what Mr. Stein writes about the Obama administration's sex education policy. Listen to this. Now, the Obama administration has entered the politically sensitive debate, promising to put scientific evidence before political ideology. A $110 million campaign will support a range of programs, including those that teach about the risks of specific sexual activities and the benefits of contraception and others that focus primarily on encouraging teens to delay sex. End quote. So in other words, this president and his administration are trying to find something of a middle ground. Now, it's not exactly in the middle. It is heavily weighted against abstinence-only sex education positions. Now, what I want you to understand from this is the language that is used here. It's the same language that this president used when he adjusted, in a very unfortunate way, President George W. Bush's position on human embryonic stem cell research. The president in both of these situations has said that he wants science to rule the question. But of course, science doesn't rule any question like this, and science can't rule a moral question. The only way to make this a scientific issue is to consider that the only risks when it comes to, for instance, teenage sexual behavior, are the risks of communicated diseases or pregnancy. You can't have a scientific approach to the moral question, and that is, of course, what this administration now seeks to avoid, evidently at nearly all costs. With the election just a few days away, the Wall Street Journal reports that Democratic strategists and Democratic candidates are now the ones who are injecting social issues into the race. It's a transparent effort, they say, to get more women to the voting place on Tuesday. I read here from the article in the Wall Street Journal, Democratic campaigns are bombarding female voters with messages about social issues on the stump and in debates, television ads, targeted phone calls, and direct mail. A group known as the Planned Parenthood Action Fund is sending mail to more than 1.4 million independent women, charging that Republicans oppose contraceptive coverage, women's health funding, and abortion rights, among other things. End quote. Now, the one issue that seems to be more explosive than any other is, unsurprisingly, the issue of abortion. The article says, pollsters say abortion is a particularly effective issue. Unlike the economy, where positions are sometimes hard to distinguish, abortion can present a clear delineation between candidates. And pollsters say, a candidate's abortion position can serve as a signal to whether he or she shares a voter's values more generally. In their article, Laura Meckler and Douglas Belkin of the Wall Street Journal are really onto something there. For many years, sociologists have pointed to an issue like abortion as what is called a transparent issue. Voters can see through it. They understand exactly what it is. It's a yes or no question. Voters recognize it as such, and they can make a one-to-one connection between a candidate's position on abortion and any number of other issues on a range of moral, value, and policy concerns. Now, as you look at this particular story, it's a reminder that the issue of morals and of social issues, the very divisive issues that the press has so often complained about being interjected into campaigns, will never be far from hand, regardless of which party seeks to ignore the question. Or, of course, in this case, to use it to its advantage. Atheists are resurgent in energy and, well, at least publications just about everywhere these days, and also, as statistical indicators tell us, in numbers. Now in Great Britain, The Guardian reports that humanists want to launch a no-religion census campaign. It turns out that there isn't really an adequate way, according to this group, for those who are unbelievers to register their unbelief with the British census. They want to know exactly how many there are, and so they're trying to launch their own census to come to a conclusion. There is a political agenda here, and it's transparent. They want more support. They want more political voice, and they want to cut back on government spending in Great Britain on churches and faith-based schools. They suggest that approximately 22.9% of respondents in official figures, that's about 13 million people in Great Britain, are either non-religious or they didn't answer the question whatsoever. You add all that together and it's more than the Muslims, Jews, Sikhs, and Hindus in their populations combined. Now, looking at this data, it is clear that if you compare the United States and Great Britain has a much larger atheist or unbelieving community. But even though church attendance rates in Great Britain are very low, there are likely still more unbelieving Britons who would rather leave the question blank than officially register themselves as unbelievers. Every once in a while, an article, whether an op-ed or a research article, appears in one of the nation's leading newspapers that leads you to scratch your head. In some cases, it makes you wonder about the credibility of the newspaper itself. That certainly is drawn into question in yesterday's column by Gregory Paul, published in the Los Angeles Times. It's entitled, What's Really Hurting Christianity in America? And he goes on to suggest that it is, quote, a grand combination of secure prosperity, mass consumerism, and advanced technology. Now, he's responding in some sense to the book by Robert D. Putnam and David E. Campbell, that is, American Grace. But he goes on to argue that religion is in recession in the United States. The numbers are receding, primarily because there are socioeconomic factors at play. He makes the argument that when Americans feel secure, they become less religious. And as Americans right now, in spite of the recession, feel long-term secure, well, they're falling away from the faith. He also goes on and suggests that mass consumerism is making a big impact in terms of religious life. He suggests, for instance, that this consumer culture is what has led to the repeal of blue laws and the fact that younger Americans simply don't want to have anything to do with what he calls the religious right. Now, if you're having trouble making all these connections, you're certainly not alone. Lastly, he suggests that it's technology that's going to make a difference. He laments that Putnam and Campbell in their book, quote, fail to acknowledge technology's role in creating a less pious America. Increasing use of consumer digital electronics is soaking up so much of young people's time and interest that they are decoupling from the social organizations that used to fill a person's life before TV and computers. Of course, organized religion is just the sort of social club that is vulnerable to this potent side effect of technology. The secularizing effect of digital technology is so potent that it threatens to overwhelm the reproductive superiority of conservative believers. End quote. If you're tempted to laugh at that point, I suggest you go right ahead. But we need to laugh, at least in part, at the Los Angeles Times. Did the editors check out the credibility of this author? Back in 2005, Gregory Paul wrote a similar article, and he got it into an academic journal, the Journal of Religion and Society. Later it was disclosed that Mr. Paul is actually a freelance paleontologist who was previously known for writing and illustrating books on theropod dinosaurs. There is no particular expertise to his ability to write in this area whatsoever. And when it comes to suggesting, for instance, that digital technology is ready to overwhelm religious faith, it fails to see that these same technologies can have the opposite effect. No doubt technology has a very important influence in the lives of people, and we should as Christians be very attentive to what those particular influences and effects might be. But when it comes to this kind of scientific argument, it ought to be made by a scientist, if it's going to be published in a credible newspaper, who has some expertise in this particular area of science. The Los Angeles Times simply identifies Gregory Paul as, quote, a scientist and an author who has written extensively on the decline of religion in the West, end quote. Well, writing extensively is a very different thing than writing credibly or intelligently. At my website at albertmoeller.com, you'll find a lead article on science trumping the Bible. It's an amazingly candid and disastrous argument that I confront and analyze in the article you will find at albertmoeller.com. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com. You'll also be able to follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/albertmoeller. For more information about the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information about Boyce College, go to boycecollege.com. I want to offer a special word of thanks to the many listeners who wrote me when I ask about the most effective and helpful link for this program. Your advice has been taken to heart, and it is deeply valuable. I'll meet you tomorrow for The Briefing.